Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording September 16th, 2020, we're talking about the United Kingdom's Integrated Review of Security, Defense, Development, and Foreign Policy with CGAI fellow Professor Julian Lindley-French and the Deputy Director of the CSIS European Program, Rachel Elthus. Rachel, Julian, welcome to Defense Deconstructed.
Hi.
Thank you.
So we're going to have a conversation today about the integrated review that the United Kingdom's undertaking across a number of different elements of its international policy. I want to spend a particular focus today looking at the defense aspects of that. Before we get into the more detailed conversation, Rachel, can you start us off just by talking about what is the nature of the exercise that's underway right now across the Atlantic Ocean for the two of us, and a little bit about what the context is for that initiative?
Thanks very much. Well, traditionally, these security and defense reviews happen about every 5 years in the UK. We saw one in 2010 and another one in 2015. And to contrast for US and Canadian listeners, possibly, this isn't just a pure defense review. This is something that looks at defense as well as foreign and security policy to include development aid. So this more comprehensive look, I think, is really a unique approach. It's led out of the Cabinet Office, of course, in cooperation with the relevant ministries. But the fact that the Cabinet Office is in the lead takes away some of the power from those individual ministries, which can bog down decisions. What they're going to be looking at is first establishing a policy baseline. What is the security environment and what is the UK's place in the world? What does it stand for in terms of interests and values? From there, they probably move on to defining their priorities and national security objectives. So what is it willing to do to defend these values and interests? And then, of course, we move on to resourcing, how it will achieve these objectives. So as I think we'll talk about later in the podcast, it's always a balance between meeting this level of ambition and the resources to get us there.
Julian, from your point of view, a little closer to it than the two of us are, and do you think that this is a particularly important time to be engaging in this type of exercise, given the strategic shifts that are underway?
It's the wrong time to be carrying out this in the midst of the COVID-19 economic crisis. It tells you all about the politics of this. You know, Rachel is right, technically, but this is the Cummings Review. And you've got to understand Dominic Cummings' agenda for this government, which is to level up the north of England, the poorer parts of UK, to hold on to new Tory voters. So the overwhelming imperative in the face of COVID-19 and the economic downturn is domestic policy. And domestic policy basically means how to make, entre guillemets, as the French would say, defense, foreign policy, development more efficient, i.e. transfer money to things like health security, which wins votes. You know, I've discussed this with very senior Brits who've been involved in the review itself. And, you know, that seems to be the dynamic basically behind it. You've got to understand contemporary Britain. It's about to go from a community of which it's been an integral part for 40 plus years, called the European Union, into anarchy, in a sense where you guys exist. In you know, you're part of institutions and you're very institutionalized, but you're not part of something called the European Union. Most of Britain's bureaucratic leaders, the high establishment, they're managers, they're not statesmen or women. And it's going to take some time for so-called global Britain to relearn the arts of statecraft as opposed to the daily management that involved the being in the European Union involved. So essentially, this is a cost-led review, and its objective from the Treasury, which is the real master here, is ensure it is cost neutral. Now, what that means in reality is that defense and the Foreign Office in particular, because development's now being folded into the Foreign Office, will be competing over a budget, and a fairly limited budget at that. As I wrote in a piece last week, there's an irony that a year ago or so, someone contracted, allegedly, a virus from a bat in a Wuhan wet market. A year later, Britain's defense policy is in a mess, and whilst China forges ahead. So, you know, how this domestic policy versus managerial approach versus the new geopolitics, which you rightly described, David, how that's going to be squared in this review. Many of us who are closely involved with British policy are profoundly concerned.
Rachel, is your sense similar in terms of whether or not the exercise is one that's got it? No, I mean, I think at this point in time, for any of the democracies that have taken on massive debt loads, including my own, you can't have any discussion without a view among some of the financially oriented folks in government about where the bottom line is or is increasingly difficult to see at the moment. But is it clear to you that there is also a significant cost constraint on this review? And I guess, how would you compare that to previous initiatives, the ones that you mentioned in the past in terms of the resource constraint?
Well, this is always a challenge. You know, of course, everyone knows what the challenges are and what the level of ambition should be. And then matching up with resources is where we really get serious. Now, in theory, the Conservative government's manifesto promises a top line increase in defense. I believe it's about 0.5% over inflation each year. But, you know, we've already seen how, you know, with all due respect, the current UK government reviews these sort of commitments. So with COVID and Brexit and the UK economy really being hit hard, I do think it's going to be hard to uphold those manifesto commitments, whether it's for defense or development. And as Julian has said, we've already seen a couple of tricks to hide those decreases by combining budgets. In the 2015 review, for example, there was a combining of roles and missions across the Ministry of Defense and Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So the people who are doing NATO and EU are essentially dual-hatted between those two ministries. And anyone who's worked in a Ministry of Defense or Foreign Affairs in their national government understands that those are not always compatible. So I think the resource environment is going to be tough. It's unclear whether some of the offsets that the UK envisions in terms of, for example, a US-UK trade deal will materialize and add more money to the overall budget. You asked about previous defense reviews, and I worked on the 2010 review in the UK Ministry of Defense. And defense was often, first of all, seen as profligate and hiding expenditure. So there was already a lot of distrust that defense got a lot of money and wasn't necessarily held accountable for that. I think that persists today. And that secondly, defense was often handed unexpected bills. So in 2010, suddenly the Ministry of Defense was told that they would have to take on the bill for nuclear modernization. So I do think that defense is going to be really fighting to hold its own corner here now that it's in competition with these global economic pressures, as well as other ministries like the foreign ministry and development and health grabbing at the same basket.
I guess as an observation from where I sit in Ottawa, it's interesting watching the discussions around commitments, whether they be for development or on defense, that have been tied into some measure of economic growth or inflation, as you're touching on, because the denominator of most of those equations is changing rapidly and not in a favorable way for people that want to see growth. Having just seen economic numbers come out here in Ottawa showing that over the summer there was virtually no inflation. But more broadly than that, what is the get you, Julian, to comment as well about the idea about whether or not defense and the other agencies are currently viewed as being good fiscal stewards? And in part, I ask that because having had some folks come over from the MOD in 2010 and talking about how the ministry was really undertaking a lot of efforts to try and effectively get its house in order and clean up that aspect of its stewardship and management of the resources. People at the time were quite optimistic. And I guess here we are 10 years later, and maybe that didn't all play out necessarily the way that they wanted it to.
The key factor is that Dominic Cummings thinks that the Ministry of Defense is profligate, in particular procurement, because of recent projects, such as the two large aircraft carriers, the heavy aircraft carriers, F-35. To some extent, though, Britain's locked into a strategy because of the choices it made many years ago. It's abandoned the continent, effectively, for the first time since 1955, possibly even 1944. In August of last year, Britain withdrew the massive bulk of its remaining forces from Germany. I was supporting them. I know that very well. the aircraft carriers cost an awful lot. The F-35 cost an awful lot. Really, given that the deterrent, the cost of the deterrent and the deterrent successor program, which will replace Trident, is effectively, excuse the pun, already sunk. The real question, the defense question at the heart of this review is concerns Britain's expeditionary capability. And the main driver of Britain maintaining a serious expeditionary capability is the United States. As always, the United States remains a cornerstone of UK defense policy. If the UK wishes to maintain influence in DC, it must be useful to the Americans in certain contingencies. And the primary contingency the Americans are concerned about is the growing weight of China on American military thought in Indo-Pacific. The possibility that the Americans might face multiple scenarios in Indo-Pacific, Middle East, and Europe, and the need for Europeans to be able to stand up a deterrent force in an emergency if that so happens. The Americans want Britain to play a leading role in that, irrespective of Brexit. This is very much a NATO-focused approach. So the challenge for the review is, can Britain work up a sensible, almost coalition hub leadership role for such an ambition with European partners whilst it detaches itself from the European Union with all the friction that involves, and maintain some influence in Washington? With respect, you know, Britain plays an important role in Five Eyes, but that's not enough. The hard yards of defense, the Americans will expect the Brits to be there. So the choice faced by the budgeteers and by the Johnson government is, does Britain abandon its traditional high-end forced entry capability, which has given Britain a lot of influence inside the alliance, and become this kind of maritime amphibious focus power projector of limited Eurostrategic means, but nevertheless still important? Or does it simply abandon that? Does it seek to kind of hide behind what I call the magic military? In 2015, that was beefed up special forces. They were going to solve all the problems of a loss of fighting power. Now Dominic Cummings is obsessed with space and cyber and the whole digital domain, which I suspect is because you can't measure that very much. And therefore, some wonderful narrative will come forward about how, whilst the British military is getting even smaller as a consequence of this review, somehow the investment in some cyber and some space will offset a loss of fighting power. I don't think the Americans will buy that. I don't think allies or partners will buy that. So I think it's going to be an interesting exercise in drafting this particular review.
Rachel, what's your sense? Earlier, you kind of touched on the high-level question about what kind of role the United Kingdom wants to play in the world going forward. What's your sense of what the answer to that is likely to be?
I think Julian's absolutely right that at the end of the day, the U.S. values the U.K.'s ability to operate alongside the U.S., but also to lead a coalition, even when the U.S. isn't present. And so I think in the first instance, I would encourage the UK to maintain that, not just to preserve the relationship with the US, but to continue to be an important player in Europe and its immediate neighborhood. The question for me, though, is, you know, how much reach that expeditionary role can have. On the one hand, you have a choice to be a strong and capable regional security actor in the Arctic and the Middle East. And for what it's worth, I think that the UK made some of the right choices in the 2015 review to bring the P-8s back online and to at least field a number of F-35s on its carrier, because those beef up its role as one of the leaders in the North Atlantic space, which I know is important for Canada as well. So on the one hand, you could be a strong, capable regional security actor in the Arctic to the Middle East. But on the other hand, and again, this is another level of resourcing and ambition, a global conventional actor. So this would require power projection capabilities that could stretch UK defense resources towards the Indo-Pacific. We've seen a little bit of this, with UK ships accompanying US carriers in the region. France does a bit of this, but in terms of the UK being the lead on a military pushback on China, I don't think that either the capability or the political will is there. So I see us somewhere in between that regional security role and that enabler for the more global role. My final point to your question here would be just to voice a concern about, you know, what Julian's aptly dubbed the Cummings Review approach, which is the impression that technology can somehow stand in for real military capability. At the end of the day, you need these capabilities. Military forces, not just Army, but the enablers that come from the naval and air power as well. And we saw the whittling down of the Army starting in the 2010 review, and then again, this almost attempt that Julian mentioned to replace the conventional forces with the special forces. I just don't think there's any more room to cut in British conventional forces. And the idea that the technology can stand in for this rather than enable it and amplify it is to me a false choice.
Can I support what Ellen just said? Rachel said, my apologies, Rachel. I was actually at RAF Kinloss in 2010, the day that Assistant Commander-in-Chief Ops came up and announced that MRA-4 was being scrapped. And that morning, I can tell you, MRA-4 wasn't being scrapped. So don't overstate or underestimate, rather, the seat of the pants nature of final decisions in reviews, because they're often kind of the result of last minute negotiation between services and service chiefs, and in this case, other ministries. The fact that Britain scrapped its maritime patrol aircraft was complete nonsense, and not least because it's vital to protecting the deterrent as it enters and exits from Faz Lane, where it's based. So the fact that the P-8s have been brought back, basically using the same avionics as the MRA-4, at immense cost. For all the problems with MRA-4, and I had long conversations with 201 Squadron about this, it did the job, and it would have made more sense to continue. Some of the planes were brand new, were scrapped. They were actually built and were scrapped. So this was a sign of the kind of, how can I put it, the frantic negotiating going on about the 2010 review. So maybe, hopefully, we can avoid that. The second point that Rachel made, which I fully agree, look, Britain, modern contemporary Britain is an important European regional strategic power. It's no longer a world power. The best thing it can do is help lead a European future force, which could act as a high-end first responder in an emergency if the Americans are busy elsewhere and overstretched. Pretensions for sailing into the Indian Ocean or the South China Sea are nonsense, not least of which because it's where future war is going with artificial intelligence, supercomputers becoming quantum computers, hypersonic missile systems. The big weakness of forward deployed British forces is defense against systems that are already here and are going to become more advanced. So the logic of all this is to take pressure off the Americans in Europe to enable the Americans to be effective deterrents elsewhere by helping to lead a Franco-German-British-European future force, which builds on E2I of President Macron and is both NATO-centric and EU-friendly. That, to me, is the only possible logical strategic conclusion one that London should draw right now. But given the nature of these reviews, I wonder if it will.
You're listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries.
To seize on one comment you just made there about the premise about you'd be undertaking a set of decisions and creating a force posture to respond if the Americans are overstretched. Is that the baseline assumption that you'd be working in an environment of that happening if the Americans are overstretched? Because I guess from my vantage point, I would also think that, and I hope folks in Canada are paying attention to the possibility that you'd be in a scenario where the Americans may not be overstretched, but they've become increasingly uninterested in contributing in the same way that they have in the past, irrespective of what the outcome of the election in November is going to be. And I'll use that as a way of asking the two of you, starting with you, Rachel, what's the, if you're looking between the United Kingdom's relationship historically with the United States, clearly you've got a kind of a global shift with an eye on China, irrespective of what individual countries choose to do about it, as well as the bloc of Europe. Which of those, the big kind of three geostrategic players, do you think are going to be most important in this exercise, and in what ways?
Well, you know, the twin pillars of the UK's foreign and defense policy and the way that it's achieved its objectives in this space have been its uniquely close relationship with the United States and its membership in the EU. And insofar as both of those have been shaken, they're kind of ripe for change. So in the case of the United States, I do think that the UK will find itself in some uncomfortable positions where it will be a challenge at times to straddle views coming from Washington and Brussels. You know, that's more obvious on things like emerging tech, data privacy, trade, financial services. But I would argue that, you know, that goes over into foreign policy as well. You know, for example, we see on Iran, the UK position is definitely much closer and aligned with its European allies and partners. So I think that U.S. relationship will come under stress as the UK is trying to straddle its relationship with Europe and its new relationship with the European Union. With regard to Europe, I mean, I am very hopeful that once we get past the current negotiations and the end of the calendar year, that everybody becomes more pragmatic, particularly in the defense space. You know, you haven't asked about France yet, but France and the UK are the only two European countries who have a strategic culture, an expeditionary mindset. They're natural partners, and this needs to become more important. Julian mentioned E2I as a potential framework. I'd also offer that the Lancaster House Agreement all the way back from 2010 has really achieved a lot. The Joint Expeditionary Force, some maritime task groups, a lot of joint doctrine and training. So there's a strong base on which to build up this relationship with France that can be agnostic almost as to the institution in which it resides. We don't need an EU framework. We don't need a NATO framework, but we do need a working operative UK-French relationship. The final pillar that I think is important here is NATO. And I do think that the UK will double down on NATO. We already see that a little bit. Back in December of 2019, the UK led the charge on integrating an offensive cyber capability into NATO's toolbox. And I think that you'll be seeing more of this in the coming years.
I'm in violent agreement with Rachel on this. I mean, let me take each of those points in turn. First, on order of priorities. For the MOD, US, Europe, China. For the FCO, Europe, US, China, which will make for some interesting debates, which Rachel knows well, and from my ancient past, I do too. The key to that will be how heavy is the National Security Council. It's been a very lightweight National Security Council hitherto. If those kind of frictions are to be resolved, it should be led, to my mind, by a cabinet-level security minister that gives it that kind of adjudicating a role in what will inevitably be some tensions between the two ministries, between defense policy and foreign policy. On the issue of U.S. disinterest, well, it's about time the U.S. was disinterested. Europeans really ought to do more for their own defense, including the Brits. And I do think that, you know, the many meetings and conferences I'm attend with high-level Europeans, too many of them think that, but once President Trump is voted out in November, it'll all go back to normal, status quo ante. Well, one, I question whether Trump might be voted out, given the baggage that Joe Biden brings to this election. Second, things are changing in the world for America. Europe is going to have to do far more, whoever is in the White House, for the Americans to be even able to underscore and guarantee Europe's future defense. It can only happen if Europeans do far more. And there, Britain, France, and Germany have a leadership role to play. Now, I agree with Rachel fully about Lancaster House. It's coming up for 10 years on. I would ideally love to see it being deepened and extended. Much will depend on the role President Macron plays in the next 2 months over the Brexit trade deal. If he plays very hard ball, which he seems to be leaning towards, France cannot expect to try and damage Britain in terms of trade and economics because of its departure from the EU, and expect a close strategic partnership with the UK in defence. It's incompatible. It simply won't work politically in the UK, given the way that the press will cover it. Therefore, you know, France indeed has some important choices to make itself about that relationship with Britain, which is important, given that Germany simply doesn't want to step up to play the role that France would like it to play. With regard to NATO, I couldn't agree more with Rachel. The problem with the British in NATO is that we've too often been the damp squib. My Oxford contemporary, Philip Hammond, was fairly instrumental in the British becoming the country that always said no to any major initiative that cost any amount of money. So Britain's got to match words with deeds in NATO. And if Britain does that and starts to invest in the future of the alliance, and the alliance has to be not just adapted but transformed, if Britain can offer a vision for that, a way forward, then I think Britain's influence will be maintained. If not, I worry where the country will be. And you know, there's always the issue of Scotland. Although England and Wales make up for over 90% of the United Kingdom, if Scotland does get another referendum within the next 10 years, the damage that will do to the morale of the country, how it sees itself, its role in the world, will be very profound indeed. So it's very hard for any country to project power when internally it is facing divisions of fundamental, almost existential nature. So the choices, the leadership, even the attitude of London in the next few years will be critical to the future role that Britain plays, either in institutions or indeed in pursuit of its own interests.
So the last question that I put to you both is for Canada, and most of the listeners of this podcast will be approaching things through a Canadian lens. You've touched on the NATO piece, and Canada has an interest in that. But even just outside of the likely scenarios you're outlining for what the United Kingdom is likely to do with respect to NATO, Canada puts a particular emphasis on both the Five and Four Eyes clubs, of which the United Kingdom and Canada are close partners on virtually every aspect of our defense architecture writ large. And then I think it's certainly arguable, and a lot of people would state that the United Kingdom, after the United States, is Canada's closest defense partnership. So Rachel, if you were Canadian looking at what is likely to come out of this, what would you be cognizant of and watching for? As you mentioned, you know, the North Atlantic is an area of particular interest for parts of our Air Force and certainly for a large part of our Navy. If you are looking forward, what should a country like Canada be looking for to come through, recognizing that we're going to be quite attentive?
Thanks, Dave. That's a fun exercise for an American to be a kinder, gentler Canadian voice here. So I will try my best. You know, I definitely think that the North Atlantic space is very important. We talk about the Arctic very broadly, but there is definitely a North Atlantic or a sort of Northeast Arctic that our three countries share together. Canada's also has a very close relationship with the United Kingdom in terms of what you're doing in the Baltic states and Poland on the enhanced forward presence. You know, I know that Canada's picked up its own leadership role there, but that's intertwined with the UK retaining its forward presence in those countries. So I think those would be the two that I would look at. And again, that goes back to that sort of North Atlantic regional European role. More broadly, I think that's where we get into the Five Eyes relationships and some of the more diplomatic and economic relationships we've built over time through Five Eyes and other fora. That's where we start to build consensus on China and tech policy and some of the things where our countries have been thought leaders in driving NATO policy or even policy in the P3 or the P5. I think we're going to see a lot of these more ad hoc partnerships come together, but Five Eyes I would expect to remain small and focused and to be a core driver for all of our countries. I think the UK backing away from Huawei was essential to saving that relationship. I do not think that the US was joking when they said that decision would have undermined trust in the security integrity of that network. So I was glad to see that decision.
Yeah, again, I fully agree with Rachel that the backing away from Huawei was absolutely essential. I was pushing very hard to get it overturned with others because it really would have been a short-term game at an immense strategic long-term cost. So I'm glad to see there's been some movement on that. But there's a broader issue here, which you raised about Canada, which I really have to put to you Canadians yourselves, which is this. I was at the base in Latvia where your troops were until recently. And I was speaking to a senior Latvian officer and about the base itself. And he said, well, it's what the Canadians want to do because that's how they do things. But if I was fighting the Russians, I wouldn't do that because the first thing that will happen is a big mushroom cloud over that base. Yes, you know, we're all constrained by cost, but we should also be driven by threat. We need our armed forces to at least have a minimal compatibility with deterrence in terms of what a potential adversary stroke enemy could throw at us. And too often in Canada's case, and increasingly in the UK's case, that is not the case. There are officers in the forward deployed battle group in Estonia, where the Brits are there, who are basically concerned that London's forgotten about them. One of them even said that to me, off the record, of course. I won't name him. So forward deployed forces, these tripwires have got to lead to something more weighty, something that would deter General Gerasimov. And that has to happen in the worst case of examples, and that involves the Americans being overstretched. So the questions that Canada and Britain should be asking themselves is not what role do they play in Five Eyes stroke Four Eyes, important though it is, but what is the minimal fighting power within the framework of NATO needed by both countries to fulfill the roles that they've committed themselves to? What is required to maintain credible deterrence to the east and offer some support to frontline states in the Mediterranean facing potential chaos in Middle East and North Africa? These are the fundamental threat-driven questions that reviews like the IR 2020 should address, but too often they don't. And I've just been doing some work on the Battle of Britain. I wrote my Oxford thesis on British policy in the coming of war. I read every cabinet minute between 1933 and 1941. And for all the talk of appeasement, the British rearmament program of the 1930s was enormous. The Battle of Britain was won because a decision was taken in 1934 and the most advanced air defense system the world had ever seen constructed by 1940. So, and that was an economy and a government facing the Depression and coming out of Depression. The task of government is not easy, but the task of government is precisely to make the right call about the balance between debt, cost, and threat. And I'm not convinced, given the framing of this review, that that indeed will be the case. And I'm not convinced that Ottawa understands these issues either. And frankly, unless Britain, Canada, European allies begin to grip this reality, the Americans cannot be the fix-all for our defense delinquency.
Well, I think that that's a less than optimistic note, but a good one upon which to stop the conversation. And I think a couple of different points there that are very much worth pursuing in the future, particularly after the outcome of the November election is clear. On whatever date in the future that may be. The last question I want to ask the two of you, as we always do to end these podcasts, after an excellent discussion, is what are each of you reading these days? Julian, I'll start with you.
Thank you. And it's been a great pleasure and great to be with you, Rachel and David. I'm reading two books at present, With Wings Like Angels by Michael Corder about the Battle of Britain. And as yesterday was Battle of Britain Day, and 80 years after September the 15th and the decisive victory. And Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman, which I'd hoped to have read in August, but is now spilt over into September.
And Dave, I read a lot of nonfiction for work. So in my free time, I always gravitate back to fiction. I'm reading a book called Americana by Chimamanda Adichie. It is about a Nigerian student who comes to the U.S. and is confronted with a lot of the race issues that you see in the news today. But it's very inspiring to put yourself in her mindset and think more deliberately about some of these issues.
Okay, excellent. Rachel, Julian, thanks again for joining us today to have this conversation about the United Kingdom's Integrated Review on Defense Deconstructed.
Thank you, David. Great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment on your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at cgai.ca/support. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go to our producers, Charlotte Duval-Antoine and Drew Phillips, for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.